Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA.
Current state here on 90.5 WKAR. We're glad you're here for Tuesday morning, and we're hoping you haven't had to repair to higher ground, as is a major issue, of course, in Grand Rapids, but also locally. I mean, there are more challenges here as well on a more minor scale, but it's something we have to keep an eye on, especially with more precipitation forecast here today. Jessica Yorko, do you know anybody who's had to a flooding emergency or anything like that in the Fourth Ward?
Well, I know both myself and one of my constituents had some fun with sump pumps, I'll call it, over the last few weeks. And it was funny because when I went to Home Depot to get a part I needed, there were lots of other people there. A lot of people replacing sump pumps and parts and dealing with a little water in the basement.
Is the ward a little low-lying?
It actually, generally? In comparison, we have some areas close to the river, but for the most part, we don't have as much floodplain as, say, the First Ward.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we're here to talk about the budget and other issues with Jessica. Yesterday, the Lansing City Council continued discussion of Mayor Virge Bernero's proposed 2014 budget. This time, the council focused on Bernero's roughly $30 million spending plan for the city's fire department. There have been calls for both the fire and the police departments to cut their budgets by millions of dollars to help address Lansing's ongoing revenue shortages. Recently, a panel of unelected community and business leaders recommended, among other things, that both fire and police contribute more to their health care coverage and move to one plan provider. And Jessica is here to update that part of the discussion. Before we get to those very important budget discussions, there's also been some tension between you and some supporters of another candidate running to represent the 4th Ward, Chong Anna Canfora. In an email a few days ago, you referred to a negative and threatening tone of someone or some people associated with Canfora's campaign, if I understand this correctly. What happened exactly?
One of my supporters contacted me late last week because of a statement made by a man named Joe DeSano, who is on record on City Pulse just a couple weeks ago, saying he is working on Canfora's campaign. And his statement was something along the lines of, stand with this, you know, this candidate, or you will be humbled the old country way. I did not know what that term meant. Then there was another, just on the heels of that, a comment by Canfora's husband saying there will be blood. And I looked up this term, and I was horrified when I read the meaning of this term, which basically means to sodomize someone.
Right, it's sexual it's some sexually violent a reference.
Yeah, basically it's about rape, which is not funny at all. And so this was extremely disturbing to me, and my supporters felt, you know, this is taking things too far. We need to ask for a clean campaign pledge, which calls for civility, honesty, relevance, and respect. And the purpose of this is people should not feel disenfranchised from the electoral process, from the voting process. And when people are making these kinds of threats, and then now my opponent is saying this person does not work on her campaign, when just 2 weeks ago we have in a local publication he's saying he does, and no one disputed that. So honesty seems to be an issue here. I run a clean campaign. I made a pact with my opponents in 2009. I don't do negative campaigning, and I think it just has absolutely no place in politics of any kind, but especially local politics. We need good information, and we can't get good, clear, relevant information when this is the kind of campaigning people want to run.
You might be facing up to three other opponents. Has there been any response to any of them regarding your call for a clean campaign pledge?
I only know of one other announced candidate, and I also sent the pledge to that person, and I have not heard back yet. My opponent, Canfora, however, has stated she will not directly to me, but to the various news media yesterday, both City Pulse and WILX TV, that she will not be signing the pledge.
She will not be signing the pledge. Okay. All right, let's move on to the city budget. The proposed budget by the mayor calls for a fire department budget of roughly $30 million. This came up yesterday. What's the discussion focusing on?
Well, there's some excellent opportunities in the fire department budget this year, and one that I'm particularly interested in is the move of our code compliance unit from the planning department into the fire department, and I led last night's discussion with questions about that move. That is one of the major budget and procedural city government tasks that my constituents have charged me with improving. And I see excellent opportunities here because the fire department and the code officers already work very closely together in terms of some safety concerns around both residential and commercial structures, access to buildings where the fire department has more authority than the code officers. And so to bring them into one area, it does still need to be fleshed out, the actual procedural
procedure.
The actual procedures is what we learned last night. And I want residents to be involved in those discussions, and I stated that last night, that we need to keep residents' voice in this process because they are the ones that experience the benefits and the disadvantages of the current system. So I want residents at the table in those procedural discussions.
But this amounts to a streamlining of operations that would result in spending less dollars.
The goal, we didn't get a lot, truthfully, into the spending side of it. The code area generates revenue, and so we don't have a big need to do a lot of chopping. It's really from that area. It's really more about improving the level of service and the efficiency and the effectiveness of the system.
But it is potentially a money-saving measure, moving code compliance to the fire department?
You know, there may be some potential savings in increased efficiency. There could be. But, the primary objective here is to improve the service and increase the information sharing and the coordination of the staff in those two departments.
Okay. Where does the police department budget discussion stand right now? What's in play there?
What's in play with police department is a pretty interesting discussion that we had last week about the station, the police station, about whether it would stay in the leased building on May Street, whether we would bring it back into City Hall. But of course, there's a conversation about whether long-term City Hall may relocate. So the station is a question. There may be some savings there. As far as healthcare and pension, as we already know, that is a matter of collective bargaining, and both police and fire have taken some concessions over the last few years that have allowed us to balance the budget and keep the working forces of those departments intact. So that is a matter of collective bargaining, and I feel good about what we've been able to do in the past, and
how much more is possible, though?
That is the golden question. That is the golden question.
Are you aware of how much resistance police and fire are putting up against paying more for health care plans, for example?
Well, it's the job of the union to get, to get good things for the workers. That's their job, and I respect that. I work closely with particularly the fire department. Union has been very open in meeting with me over the years and explaining to me the different things they face in their contracts and how it can affect their workforce. So,
should they take a cut, though? I mean, should they be prepared to pay more for their health care plans?
Well, we have...
Is that just the right thing to do at this point?
we have some state requirements that everyone's going to have to follow anyways. So, I'm not here to say what they should and shouldn't do. That is a matter of collective bargaining.
Okay. Do you support the mayor's call for residents to pay, I think it's $5 million, $5.5 million or so more for street lights and water?
It's an interesting proposal. I think that the effect for our residential customers is fairly minimal when we're looking at, $1 or $2 a month. And it's interesting, and I think it's responsive. It's responsive to residents, because I attended a number of sessions called City Hall on the Road last year, and people came up to me and they came up to the mayor saying, don't cut services further. If you need to institute some new fees, if you need to raise taxes further, we would prefer that, because we understand the limitations of the Headley laws and the decline in property values. We know that we're all paying less property tax, but when our city services decline, our property values drop further. So they're telling us, people are telling us, if we have to pay fees and new taxes, we'd prefer that than further cuts to services.
That raises an interesting point, though, because whether or not it's a tax or a fee is really an important, it sounds like a minor thing, but it's really an important thing. A couple of local attorneys with a history of addressing municipal revenue told City Pulse that the additional charges constitute a tax, not a fee, and that legally taxes require a popular vote. Any response to that?
I wondered if that sort of question would emerge, and I think it's important for us to respect the regulations that are in place surrounding those questions, and I'll look forward to our city attorney weighing in and moving forward on her advice.
You addressed the General Motors tax break last night, or at least it was on the agenda. What happened there?
We approved the personal property tax exemption for General Motors, and that creates an additional 150 jobs at the Grand River Assembly Plant. And I am delighted to see General Motors reinvesting in our community. I know that the neighborhoods adjacent to the site, that is in the 4th Ward, and there is a lot of unused surface parking and paved area right next to the river there that we do want cleaned up, beautified, better use of the land there as far as stormwater and impacts
on
the river.
Could GM be doing more on that count?
I believe that they could, and I look forward to having that discussion with them. I wished that that would have taken place in the Development and Planning Committee before the vote came out to council. I'm not on the Development and Planning Committee this year, and the members of that committee must not have seen it fit to work on that those questions in committee. So left with, you know, voting last night and moving the issue forward, I decided let's move forward and continue the conversation with General Motors about improving the site.
Jessica Yorko is running for re-election to Lansing's 4th Ward, and she's currently sitting on the Lansing City Council representing that ward. Jessica, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Its current state, you're listening to 90.5 WKAR. This year, record low water levels have spurred the Michigan government to spend over $20 million on dredging. Many hope dredging will enable recreational and commercial boating to continue, preventing revenue loss from shipping and tourism. However, the plan could still cost Michiganders. Dredging can stir up contaminated sediments, causing environmental and health issues. Michael Alexander works in the Department of Environmental Quality's Water Resource Division. He joins us to discuss how the dredging could impact the environment. Welcome to Current State, Michael.
Good morning.
Dredging certainly sounds like a simple enough process, but let's spend a minute on that process. How is sediment removed in dredging, and where does it go?
Well, it can be removed in a variety of ways. Mechanical excavation is the most common that you will see. It is typically removed with excavators or sometimes removed with hydraulic dredges, where they actually will kind of churn it up and vacuum it out with water along with it, kind of like a vacuum along the bottom. Just depends on how big the project is. The material, depending on what's inside the material, the sediment itself, could go upland for fill material if it's uncontaminated, or it can go into appropriate disposal facilities, such as a Type 2 landfill.
Okay. And I take it there is the possibility of contaminated sediment to be disturbed here. How likely is that?
It's actually not as likely as you might think. It can be very dependent on where you're dredging. And we track contaminants around the state as best we can to try and identify those areas where we need a little extra care to be taken while the excavations are being done so we don't create any worse problems.
Can you give us an example that everybody would be familiar with geographically?
Geographically, the Kalamazoo River is an example. There's a PCB hotspot downstream by Lake Allegan and farther down from there.
So this is not related to the oil spill.
No, not related to the oil spill.
They're doing their own dredging.
That's correct.
Due to the oil spill, the Enbridge spill. But yes, this sir. Is a PCB site.
This is a PCB site based on some historical activities from the old paper mills and things like that in the area. And we're aware of that. One of the areas that where the recreational dredging is being impacted by that contamination is in the Kalamazoo Lake, down by the mouth into Lake Michigan. And we're doing our due diligence there, making sure that we have the material appropriately characterized. We have appropriate disposal facilities. They're pretty low-level PCBs, but they're areas that we want to make sure that they're maintained or dredged properly. That material.
How careful do you have to be?
Well, what we would like to ensure for these low-level things is that the material is not resuspended in the water column and then drifts downstream to somewhere else. So a lot of these dredging activities will be done behind curtains. That will require some monitoring to make sure that the suspended solids stay behind these silt curtains that hold that material back.
So you got curtains actually in the water.
Actually in the water.
Preventing. So you stir this stuff up, mm-hmm. and as a precaution to keep it from drifting downstream, it encounters a curtain.
That's correct.
That stops it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And that's effective?
It's very effective.
That's been found to generally be effective?
Yes, sir.
Okay. You mentioned how the PCBs got there. This was a paper mill?
There was a series of paper mills along there back quite a while ago. and they're actually working in the upstream areas where the original sources were for cleanups. Those are environmental cleanups that take a great deal of effort to maintain and to ensure that material is not moved downstream and that it's protective of human health and wildlife.
Okay. There's a permit process involved in dredging. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you're correct. Anybody that wants to dredge in inland waters of the state, they would be required to obtain a dredging permit. It's right now we're hitting record levels of these permit applications for recreational dredging. I'm not sure of the numbers, but we are mobilizing a lot of staff to work on these. Mm. And right now the process takes anywhere from 60 to 90 days to get a permit.
In the end, Michael, how difficult is it to balance environmental concerns associated with dredging with the economic concerns?
You know, it's difficult. It's taken a lot of extra staff time to ensure that we identify areas where we need special care. But at the end of the day, I think it's something that we've done a very good job and we'll continue to do a good job to balance the environmental benefits and potential impacts from dredging these recreational harbors with the economic needs of the communities.
Historically, are there any instances of dredging operations that have resulted in environmental consequences, unanticipated negative environmental consequences?
None significant that I'm aware of.
Okay. And you say the number of permits for dredging is at an all-time high.
It's my understanding it is. Yeah, okay. I don't have the numbers right off the top of my head, but we're approaching our all-time highs for historical dredging.
If we continue to see low water levels and we continue to dredge into the future, does the deeper we go, what challenges does that create?
Well, it depends on the type of apparent material that we are ultimately getting into, whether we're getting into more bedrock, really hard rock material to get out, or whether it's a softer material. You know, eventually we'll get through those historical contaminated areas, so we'll get into more of a mechanical problem, I would say, of just trying to keep it dredged. But, you know, I'm not sure when we'll reach that point.
How does it break down with regard to harbors and rivers, and different bodies of water? Where is most of the dredging likely to take place then?
In the Great Lakes areas, adjacent to the Great Lakes areas,
oh,
yes.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
That's where we're seeing most of our applications, and right in the harbors next to the Great Lakes.
Do you feel you're on the threshold of just a greater amount of greater reliance on dredging? Do you feel like that is going to be an ongoing thing into the unforeseeable future?
It's hard to say right now, but I know there's a lot of federal agencies that are evaluating the effects of climate change on low water levels in the Great Lakes, and we'll know more in years to come whether this will be just a cyclical problem or whether it's going to be a more long-term problem.
I'm curious if you have any involvement or response to the federal Great Lakes Initiative. Does your office have anything to do with the millions that President Obama wants to spend on the Great Lakes?
For the Great Lakes Initiative?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. We're involved in that quite a bit. As a matter of fact, we have leveraged, I think we're into the $40 to $50 million for environmental cleanups under the Great Lakes Legacy Act, and our sister programs within the DEQ continue to leverage a lot of the GLRI money towards habitat improvements and delisting our areas of concern within the Great Lakes. So we're very active within the DEQ in pursuing those federal funds and to bring them to Michigan and to put them to use.
And is more money going to be assigned to that in the future then?
I hope so.
Yeah.
It's our goal that it just depends on the federal budget and how that pans out in the future.
But so it's an ongoing topic.
Yes, sir.
In Washington,
absolutely.
D.C., the Great Lakes.
Yes, sir.
Okay, very good. Michael Alexander works for the Department of Environmental Quality's Water Resource Division, the Department of Environmental Quality. Michael, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Coming up on Current State, we'll talk with MLive's Angela Whitrock about business, development, and the economy. And we also have word of an interesting turf war that's unfolded here in Ingham County over court records. We'll tell you about that coming up on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Stay with us. Welcome back to Current State. We're glad you're along here for Tuesday. I'm Mark Bayshore. You can reach us at currentstate@wkar.org with your ideas, feedback, etc. currentstate@wkar.org. A minor turf war over public records is taking shape in Ingham County. While the dispute's being downplayed by its two key participants, Clerk Barb Byram and Chief Circuit Court Judge Janelle Lawless, some observers suggest it's symptomatic of a larger ongoing problem, poor public access to documents. I recently visited with both Barb Byram and Judge Janelle Lawless to learn more. To start, Clerk Byram explained how she learned of the dispute.
Well, early in to my term, I deputized all of the clerks so that they could handle circuit court records and files. I did not want to disrupt the court, and I took a slow approach trying to get a lay of the land, and it was requested that I put something in writing of my proposal or my intent, and I did so. And the chief judge of the circuit court did respond, and I have since responded to her again in writing. I think this is a friendly disagreement. And I think we all have a job to do, but I think it is time for the people of Ingham County that the county clerk act as the clerk of the circuit court, because I ran on transparency and accountability, and that is what this would offer.
Can you give me an example of how this plays out on a day-to-day basis? Is there an incident where the impact of this has created a problem?
Yeah, the impact of this has created a problem in that when people want copies of their judgment of divorce, I cannot easily access those. When I'm being contacted because someone has been drafted for jury duty 3 times in the past 4 years, I reach out to the people that I know to reach out to in the administration, but yet they're not responding to me. It has gotten so far that I've been told that I need to pay for court files or court records, documents, and that is...
You've had to pay for public court records that ostensibly you are... in charge of overseeing?
Yes, I was told that I need to start paying for records if I want them. So I'm supposed to have the care and custody of these records, and I think that's important. And I think that was that the intent there was to have a check and balance system. You know, the court has a job to do, and I have a job to do, and I look forward to working with the circuit court and getting those jobs done and allowing for accountability and transparency.
So there's no doubt in your mind that the county clerk clearly is the ultimate person in charge of all the county's public records, even those previously overseen by the courts.
Yeah, the county clerk is to be the clerk of the circuit court. I am to have the care and custody of the records so that when the press contacts me for a status of a case, or when a woman in Japan needs a copy of her judgment of divorce so that she can get a birth certificate for her child, I should be able to produce those documents. And right now I am being banned or barred from producing those documents.
And where does this stand right now?
Right now, it stands. I submitted a letter in response to Chief Judge's letter, and I expect her to hopefully reply. And
this is Janelle Lawless, correct?
Yes, this is Chief Judge Lawless. And, you know, this is a friendly disagreement, and I am confident that an agreement will be found.
That was Ingham County Clerk Barb Byram. I then took the elevator to Judge Janelle Lawless's offices, who also downplayed the dispute.
Well, I would call it a friendly disagreement, if I even call it a disagreement. The Constitution provides that the county clerk is the custodian of the records for the circuit court. So, you know, obviously we're a court. We absolutely plan on complying with the Constitution. I would say probably What's happening here is because historically the court's been in charge of its own records and its own custodian, that what we have to work out here is how any transition is going to happen, or how that transition over to the county clerk is going to happen, and exactly what all of that means.
But you don't intend to resist it?
Oh, no. The Constitution says what the Constitution says, and we're a court of law, and we certainly plan on following the Constitution.
It's my understanding Clerk Byram apparently was required to pay to obtain a document from someone in the county clerk system, a record that is ultimately her responsibility. That would seem to indicate some kind of problem with this setup.
Well, you know, I have to say, as Chief Judge, I don't know anything about her having to pay for any document. We charge the public a reasonable fee for copying documents. So I don't know if that was that fee because she was turning that document over to a constituent, which would be part of that public. I don't know.
Would a change like this improve the public's access to records in the county?
I don't believe that it would. I think that we provide open access to all of the files that the clerk would be able to provide the same access, I guess. So I don't think that would happen. In fact, I would assume any transition, and this is what we would like to work on, obviously, is to make sure if there is that transition between the custodian of the circuit court records from the court to the clerk, that it's relatively seamless so the public doesn't have any problems with it. You know, it isn't inconvenient to the public that, you know, they still have that access that they have right now. We have access through computers and everything else, and we intend on trying to make sure that access continues.
Sounds like over the course of 30 years or so, this system has become kind of a part of everybody's DNA. Is it fair to put it that way?
I think that's very fair. And, you know, obviously the other thing from the court's perspective that I have to be concerned about are the staff, not just the public and making sure that the public gets the service that they're entitled to, but also the staff that are here that might be involved in those records have been employees of the circuit court pretty much the whole time they've been employed here. And I think it causes them some anxiety of thinking that now someone else is going to be coming in and, you know, might be their boss. So we want to make sure that whatever kinds of, again, transitions there are, we're looking at how that's going to be best handled for our staff as well.
That was Ingham County's Chief Circuit Court Judge Janelle Lawless. Now, current state producer Joe Lindstroth has also worked on this story, and he joins me now to share what he's learned. Hi, Joe.
Hello, Mark. How are you? Thanks for having me on the show.
Good, sure. Where are we now, then?
Well, I think first you mentioned it right at the top. It's pretty clear this is a bit of a turf battle between the county clerk and the chief circuit court judge. You know, but that said, as Chief Judge Lawless mentioned, Clerk Byram has the law on her side. And it's written into the Michigan Constitution that the county clerk is the custodian of the circuit court records. And the circuit court is the only one specifically mentioned, so it's not district court or probate court or appellate court. It's just the circuit court where this arrangement is bound by the Constitution. And then there is a further precedent with the 2003 Michigan Supreme Court decision from Lapeer County, between the Lapeer County clerk and the family courts, that seemed to kind of further solidify that ultimately the county clerk is the custodian of the records, mm-hmm. and that Barb Byram has the law on her side and where, as far as this is concerned. So the next step is the transition. Again, as Judge Lawless mentioned, where do we go from here? You know, I spoke with the chairperson of the Ingham County Commissioners, Deb Nolan, and this is on her radar. They are aware of this, but they still have yet to figure out what that transition is, how it will take place, when it will take place. Because the county commissioners do have control over the budgets, so they can, you know, decide to shift the budget from the circuit court back to the county clerk in terms of, you know, staffing and the filing and all that kind of thing. If they want, they Deb Nolan did also say they are going to bring in the state court administrator's office, which among their many duties is charged with mediating some of these disputes between the county clerks and the circuit courts.
Okay.
So, you know, that's pretty much where we are right now. We're kind of uncertain. I think, you know, moving beyond the fact that this is a political disagreement, shall we say, where the public interest comes in is access to records and I think taxpayer money. You know, this has happened for about 30 years. This has been going on for 30 years. And any transition that we move back to bringing it under the county clerk's
oversight,
you will, you know, is that going to cost any taxpayer money to do that? And then, you know, and then also, you know, in the transition, is that going to, you know, slow down the timely access, the public's timely access to the records, to the court records? Those are kind of things to be watching.
How common is this type of setup in Michigan?
Well, the short answer is not very. You know, when we spoke to the state court administrator, Chad Schmucker, you know, he said there were really no precedents to be looked at for the model of this transition. So this has never been done before, at least according to Chad Schmucker, this sort of transition back from the circuit county clerk's office to the county clerk. So, you know, that said, he also said there are, you know, county clerks and circuit courts have varying arrangements all over the state. Some county clerks are present in the circuit courtrooms for all of the hearings. Some aren't. Some just rely on video records instead of court reporters and, you know, who has control over those video records. So it sounds like there, you know, are different arrangements in different counties. But it also did seem like this seemed to rise above ordinary disputes as well.
Okay. And how did we get to this place anyway? You've referred to a 30-year history with this arrangement here. What happened 30 years ago?
Well, that's where, I mean, it kind of gets interesting. I mean, again, of course, it comes back to politics. the closest we can kind of nail down, and I spoke to quite a few people, you know, who were around at this time, and the closest I could get with the memories was about 79-80, when Ling Brewer was the Ingham County clerk, and I did speak with Ling. He seemed to fall out of favor with the more conservative circuit court, which was led by Chief Judge Jack Warren at the time. It seems there were some things that Ling said and did that caused the court, shall we say, to lose faith in his role as the guardian of the court's records. Some pretty colorful stories. I don't really think it's necessary to go into those specifics. I didn't double-check them. They're 30 years ago. I mean, there are some interesting stories there, but, you know, I think to Ling's credit, he was very gracious to say to me that, you know, he did admit to that he was in the wrong of some of the things he said and did at the time, and that Chief Judge Warren actually did have some reason to go after him. But he did call this, quote, a wonderful brouhaha. So, you know, about in 79-80, there was some tension, and this was a pretty big deal back then. And, you know, he said the court basically told him that they'd trash his name around the county, and if that didn't work, they'd try to oust him from office if he didn't relinquish control over the circuit court records.
How about that?
So with that, you know, he agreed to hand over the circuit court records over to the circuit court records back to the circuit court chief judge's, you know, jurisdiction.
But it hasn't really become an issue now for quite a long time. So everybody's had a long time to acclimate to this setup. Why has this why has it been allowed to go on for so long?
I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, you heard Chief Judge Lawless say it was in the DNA of the situation. You know, and I spoke with Peter Houck, who went on to be chief judge in Ingham County after this original arrangement was made. And he said, you know what, I mean, it's kind of the old saw, to use your phrase, Mark, that if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Okay.
I mean, he liked to say that the circuit court clerks were humming along nicely. Everything was working smoothly. And he was chief judge when Ling Brewer then left the Ingham County clerk's office to become state representative. And so they needed to appoint his successor, which ended up being Mike Bryanton. And curiously, part of, and this is what Peter Houck told me, is part of the arrangement that Mike Bryanton had to accept to become Ingham County clerk was to continue what was happening here, to keep the circuit records. And he even said, Peter Houck said, that they drew up an agreement.
Okay.
And he had to sign something to keep it this way. So fast forward, here we are to just, you know, this last election. Bryanton was clerk all the way up until, you know, Barb Byram was just elected. And Barb would like the control of the records back, and so here we are.
She would like not to have to pay for records that are ostensibly under her control.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. If yeah, exactly. That gets a little murky on, you know, how that went down. But yeah, exactly. And you know, and I think quite honestly, it went so long because no one complained. Yeah. It was working. It was working fine.
What's next then? We got a transition ahead of us.
Yeah, exactly. Transition is next. Again, you know, Commissioner Nolan said they're working that transition out. I think the things to keep an eye on, aside from the political junkies who like a good power struggle, would be three things really. You know, will this transition cost taxpayers any money? I think the fair thing to say is that this shouldn't cost a dime. Second, you know, will the circuit court's ability to run its daily operations smoothly and efficiently be compromised due to this transition?
Okay.
You know, will court files be missing? Will judgments be delayed, et cetera, because of you know, how this goes about? And then thirdly, will the public's timely access to records be negatively affected in any way? You know, Michigan already has a dismal record of transparency of open records. I mean, the Center for Public Integrity ranks it 44th out of 50. So it's just something to keep an eye on. And I think, lastly, it's just worth noting that, you know, these records aren't the county clerks. They aren't the circuit court judges. They belong to the public.
Mm-hmm.
And if this transition impedes or infringes on the public's access to them, I think that's something to keep an eye on.
Okay. Very good. Joe Lindstroth, thanks for all the good work.
You're welcome.
All right. It's Current State. You're listening to 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Every week, MLive's Angela Whitrock and I look over economy and business stories that have made the news. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mark.
Any delayed onset muscle soreness from the half marathon on Sunday?
Yesterday was the worst. Today is not so bad. I'm back in heels and ready to rock another run.
I know you were really proud of your performance. Some nice Facebook posts, which kept your followers up to speed. What will you remember from this event?
You know, I was so surprised at the amount of people that spent their morning and really their whole day Sunday out on the course cheering us on, and you know, people handing us M&Ms or people in the neighborhood setting up their own water stands. Or, you know, what will really stick with me is at the very end of the race, I was just about ready to be done. And I sort of just wanted to take a nap on the sidewalk and not finish. And this guy came running up as I was walking and sort of stretching. And he was wearing an Emergent BioSolutions race shirt. And he just gave me this little wave and said, "Come on." And I was like, "Ah, fine, I'll finish this." And I ended up setting a personal record for myself in the half marathon, better than 20 minutes, better than my last time. And,
wow.
You know, that guy, I don't know who he is, but dude in the red Emergent BioSolutions shirt, high five. Thank you so much.
And when's your next outing? I know you got a summer of a few more half
marathons.
It's the
summer of running. Yeah, I'm going to do the Cullman 5K this week, the Grand Rapids Riverbank Run, which is 15 miles, the week after, the Bay Shore half, the Ann Arbor half, maybe the Glen Arbor half, Grand Rapids half.
Where did all of this enthusiasm come from? Or have you been running for years and years, or is this a rededication?
I started running around the time I turned 30, and I have sort of become obsessed with it the last year and a half or 2 years, because it's the only time when I get to not talk to people. And so I get to be left alone for a few hours. And so it's sort of my zen.
Everybody associated with Current State wants you to run on their behalf, too, by the way.
Deal.
So we don't have to. You could just put in another 50 yards or so. We'll just call it good, okay? And you brought your medal in here this morning. We got the Chevy Traverse on the medal,
right,
for the Lansing Marathon.
Maybe in a couple of years they can put the Camaro on there. That would be pretty sweet.
You know, what crossed my mind also was just to what extent the Boston incident was on people's minds. And I'm thinking the finish line of the marathon,
right,
must have been poignant in terms of just a connection to what had just happened in Boston.
Right. You know, there was a they were checking our bags as we came in, and, you know, obviously there are some sort of civil liberties questions there, but primarily it was about safety and security. And really, you know, running is a hard thing to do. It's time away from your family. It's time away from things that are a lot more fun than, you know, shin splints and muscle pulls. And crossing the finish line, it was just, you know, people that we all knew were staying there waiting to give us our medals. And it was just this overwhelmingly positive experience to think, you know, again, it's a Sunday morning, it's cold outside, and these people are here just waiting for us to do this really sort of insane thing, and they're happy for you.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no better feeling, really.
Yeah. Well, congratulations to everybody around. Congratulations to you, Angela. On to business here. The State Journal's Lindsay Van Holly reported over the weekend, and the journal followed up with an editorial today commenting about this as well. This is about Lansing Township and its unanticipated challenges trying to drive new development in the area of the Eastwood Town Center. What's this about?
Well, Lansing Township did something sort of unusual and sort of unprecedented a few years ago. They decided that when expanding Eastwood Town Center, they would, instead of using a sort of middleman developer, they would do it themselves. So they issued bonds and they started planning a redevelopment, which would include that performing arts center, the hotel, et cetera. There have been some delays. It's sort of murky as to what's holding that up. But in the process of doing so, you know, each municipality has a limit to the amount of debt it can carry, you know, debt being in the form of bonds. Most municipalities use that debt for things like parking ramps, or sometimes they issue bonds on behalf of a developer, as East Lansing did for part of the City Center 2 project. What Eastwood did is they used their bonds to develop their own property, or to develop some property they were leasing. So that sort of has handcuffed them a bit when it comes to what they can do for developers, and that's sort of what the LSJ has been really hammering them on lately, is that there's a developer that would like this, would like the township to help them finance a development, but the township, in financing its own development, can't take on any more debt.
Right. So, and according to state statute, as you pointed out, a charter township, it cannot borrow once its debt exceeds 10% of the township's taxable value. So they have just a couple of options. They either increase their property tax revenue in the township, or they figure out some other way to reduce their debt.
Right.
Am I right about that?
And short term, I mean, neither of those things are really possible. So they're sort of in a holding pattern. You know, what I find really interesting about this is that, you know, the township takes a lot of flack for what they did in issuing bonds to finance their own development.
Well, it stirred up controversy at the time. I don't think it was lost on anybody that for a township to put its taxpayers on the hook for a commercial development,
right,
was pretty unusual.
And, you know, to be fair, cities and townships around the state, and certainly locally, put their taxpayers on the hook constantly for other developments, too. It's just there's a sort of a veil between them that doesn't exist here. You know, taxpayer dollars often subsidize developments in Lansing and East Lansing. Everywhere you look, development is subsidized by taxpayers. It's just usually through different devices like a tax capture or a brownfield or something that it happens instead of the actual taxpayers bonding. The difference here is that the township stands to make a lot more return on investment than a normal city would because of it. So yeah, it's a higher risk, but the potential reward is substantial, especially for a tiny place like Lansing Township.
Mm-hmm. We'll keep an eye on it. Elsewhere on the development front, you've mentioned the Hopcat Brew Pub a few times recently here on Current State, and I hear they broke ground yesterday. Remind us where and remind us what the Hopcat is all about.
Hopcat is taking up the first floor of the Residences, which is an 8-story building at the corner of, I think it's Albert and Grove in downtown East Lansing. It's right next to St. Anne's Lofts, right by LS Techo, that sort of area of downtown there. Hopcat comes out of Grand Rapids. It's a tremendously successful brew pub. They focus on craft beer and delicious food, and they win award after award after award.
Wow.
So here, when they open, which is set to be very beginning of August, mark your calendars, they will have more than 100 craft beers on tap, and then some in bottles. It's going to be a real tremendous establishment and hopefully something that will draw more people downtown.
Great. MLive's Angela Whitrock, thanks for joining us today, as
thanks,
always.
Mark.
Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we hear from sports writer Paula Pasch about her book, 101 Things Lions Fans Should Know or Do Before They Die. In addition, we're joined by House Democratic leader Tim Grimmel. Also, tune in for the music. Where else are you going to hear music by a modern Tuareg player from Niger, as well as electronic tracks from top producers in New York City and soul and funk music like we're playing now, all in one program? If you want to find out more about the music we play on Current State, follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Sonia Treweiler for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.